HanselMinutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman, hosted by Carl Franklin. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 161, recorded live Friday, May 8th, 2009. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. And by .NET Developers Journal, the world's leading .NET developer magazine. Online at www.sys-con.com. In this episode, Scott talks with Mustang Software founders Jim Herer and Scott Hunter.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes. And today we're talking about bulletin board systems. And I've got on the phone with me Jim Herer and Scott Hunter, founding members of Mustang Software. And you may remember Wildcat, the Wildcat bulletin board system. Thanks, Jim and Scott, for sitting down with me today.
It's great to be here. Thanks for inviting us.
Hey, Scott. Thanks for inviting us.
Yeah, absolutely. Jim, who is who? Who started what? You were the CEO, right?
Yeah, I was the original founder and CEO. I kind of started, Scott and I met on CompuServe back in 85, because we both had PC juniors and we kind of started playing with the idea of could we write a bulletin board system for the PC junior, because everybody said it couldn't be done because if you remember way back then, the modem was a non-Hayes compatible modem back then. We just kind of did it as a project just to see if we could, you know, write a mini BBS. And then I kind of got hooked into the idea of learning how to program and wanted to learn how to program Turbo Pascal. And so kind of started on a project to write a bulletin board under Turbo Pascal.
It's kind of funny. If you go back to that era, you know, Jim and I both have like 300 baud modems and we both bought these awful IBM computers called PC Juniors that were incompatible with half the world, but they were cheap. Mm-hmm. And we're on CompuServe, which was the big dial-up service before the internet, and asking, you know, where can I find a BBS that runs on this thing? And ran into a character that had a Turbo Pascal bulletin board called Colossus. And I think the guy that worked on that was Jim Plunkett. I'd met him and his BBS did not work on the PC Junior, but I talked to him and he's like, hey, I'll give you the source code and maybe you can try to make this thing work with the PC Junior. So I got the source code for that and started playing with Turbo Pascal. This is like Turbo Pascal 1 or 2. Still impressive, I think, even in today's term, to think that those compilers back then, you know, compiled in like 1 second, you know, thousands of lines. But we took Colossus and I took it and played with it a little bit, and then I'd met Jim online, a friend of ours, Don Watkins, who ran some of the forums on CompuServe. He ran the PC SIG on CompuServe, introduced Jim and I to each other, and next thing I know, I've got the Colossus source code, and I throw it over to Jim, and Jim and I start running this thing, and that's when Jim had the idea of, you know, Colossus was kind of stagnant, wasn't going all the directions we wanted, and that's when Jim had the idea of starting up his own bulletin board. And I remember I was, at the time, Jim was in California. I lived in Little Rock, Arkansas, and he called me one night, and we had this huge brainstorming session on the phone and about how we would build this thing and what databases we would use and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And then we don't talk for about 6 months. And then I'll throw the bone back over to Jim here, because, you know, during that 6 months, he was out there going and cranking on building the first cut of Wildcat.
Yeah, it was kind of an interesting time because I didn't know how to program, and obviously back then, you know, there was no courses on Turbo Pascal or anything like that. The schools were still teaching Fortran and Cobalt and all those classes, so, you know, you had to pretty much learn how to program out of a book. So I just started, you know, I got all the books I could on Turbo Pascal, and then I met guys like John Friel, who were kind enough to, you know, give me some of the source code, assembly source code that had the communications layer in it. At that point, I went ahead and bought a clone PC at the time, I think one of the very first ones that came out, to try to, you know, because the PC Junior just wasn't really getting it from that standpoint. And then, you know, met the guys at Turbo Power. Remember the guys at Turbo Power, Scott? And you know, they kind of helped me with some, some objects and functions and procedures, and just started really just did it as a labor of love, just really to learn how to program and to get it running. The first BBS we had was it called Junior Country or something like that? It was a BBS that was running on a clone PC, but it had all of the every single kind of app you could think of for PC juniors and stuff. So that's kind of how everything kind of started.
You keep talking about getting help from people. You're doing this online. This is 25 years ago on a 300 baud modem, and you're logging into CompuServe, talking in the forums, asking questions.
Yeah, well, that was and calling these other people's BBSs as well. So, you know, John Friel, who was the original author of QModem, had a BBS. I don't remember how we ran into the Turbo Power guys, but it's kind of funny, you know, that especially with me at Microsoft, Jim and I, Wildcat was one of the first big applications that was written on Turbo Pascal, which became Borland Pascal. And so, just like we have insiders groups that come up and talk to the ASP.NET team at Microsoft, Jim and I were part of that team for Borland and Turbo Pascal. So while we're building the early versions of the BBS and stuff, yeah, we'd get a call from Borland once a year, and we'd go up there and we were actually at Anders Helsberg's house, because he was throwing these parties. You know, this is the guy who created Turbo Pascal and now is the author of C# and Link and all these Microsoft technologies.
And you're hanging out at his house.
And we would go up once a year, see what the new Borland technology was going to be, and go have dinner at his house.
Wow, was it a nice house? Was he like a superstar then?
He was a superstar then, but I mean, I would say that America as a whole is kind of blown up since then. I think successful in '85 or '87 was not what successful in 2005 was. It was nice. It was in Scotts Valley. It was all nice area and stuff.
Mm-hmm. I actually remember those trips, very vividly. And what I thought was amazing was I was always in awe because, here I was meeting the guy that wrote Turbo Pascal, but they were so personable. I mean, they're so reachable, and they just love sitting down and talking about stuff. And I just, I really was just taken by the fact that it was, that the community was just willing to share anything. I mean, just, ideas, concepts, how to do certain things. And I think that's what attracted me to the whole industry, in general, was the fact that I could get on CompuServe and from CompuServe, I found out about bulletin board systems. And then from bulletin board systems, I found out about FidoNet and other things. And then started really digging into this and found that everybody I met, all the sysops that I met were just willing and able to share, concepts mm-hmm. and ideas and everything. And I think that's, that was really the first social network, I think, that really evolved. And it was because we could sit in our, I could sit in my home in Bakersfield, California, and use a modem and connect to people around the world. And mm-hmm. I think that's really was the big attraction for me.
Well, let's back up a second and give some of the listeners, maybe some of the younger listeners and some of the international listeners, some of the glossary of terms that we've been banding around here. So originally you were saying in 1985 you were using a 300 baud modem. I think that's fair to say that's a 300 BPS or bits per second modem.
Right.
So it's 300 bits, right, in a second, which is about 37 bytes a second, which is... And a K is 1,000 plus bytes. This is a pretty slow thing that we're talking about.
Yeah, when you were reading messages on a screen, you could watch the screen slowly paint itself.
So it's almost like a remote typewriter.
Exactly. It was like a remote typewriter. It's like watching the movie War Games when you see the text mm-hmm. scrolling across the computer screens and stuff at a really slow rate. I mean, today we complain when our browser doesn't, draw like 30 pictures and everything in like 2 seconds.
Exactly.
And these days, you might wait 4 or 5 seconds for just text. No pictures, no images at all, just text to come across.
Put that into the context of a single K, what we think of as a very small unit. You're looking at about 30 seconds to get 1,000 bytes.
Yes.
So then you think about someone who wants to send an image. That's a big deal.
Yeah, and you know, and the other thing about those times is, you know, we used to at a 300 baud modem, we used to say we'd paint a word. Then when we first got the Hayes 1200 baud modems, which Scott and I both paid over $1,000 to get when they first came out, we thought that was amazing because it painted a line.
Yeah.
You know, and then we followed the whole thing. 2400 baud, I never forget, you know, when 2400 baud came out, the Hayes 2400 baud modem, and then US Robotics came out with the very first that I remember anyways, 9600 baud modem, and you know, so we followed it all the way to all the way up.
When there were standards wars that were happening, you know? Remember that
right.
It was like, who's going to win? And then there was a device that I think I spent $300 for what they were calling a V.everything, which was
right.
just a modem that said, whatever it is, we'll speak it because we're not going to fight. It was kind of the equivalent of a VHS and Betamax player all in one thing. And it was the size of a modern laptop.
The modem wars are great for the BBS community because we got them almost for free. Because, you know, the way the modem things worked, you know, if you were sitting at home and you wanted to call my bulletin board, you'd want my bulletin board to have the fastest modem available, so if you had a fast modem, it would work. And so
right.
Hayes and US Robotics and all these modem companies, man, they would throw these modems at us. The modem would cost, you know, if you were an end user, the modem, brand new modem, might cost like $1,100 for a 9600 baud modem. But they were giving them to sysops for like $100, basically at probably at cost.
Right. There were programs for basically you register your bulletin board. Right.
Exactly. If we don't run the fast modem, then why would anybody buy it? I mean, because the people are connecting to us. So it was... It was a fun time from that perspective as well, because, you know, all the new technology, if you were a sysop and actually ran a BBS full time, and they did do checks to make sure you ran a BBS full time. If you ran it full time, you know, you got all that hardware for cheap.
And now sysop may be an obvious word, but sysop, S-Y-S-O-P, is a systems operator. The person that owns the bulletin board is a sysop.
That's correct.
Yeah, that's the guy. In today's terms, he'd be the webmaster. He'd be the guy that's running the site. And the other thing that was interesting during that time from a development point of view, from a programming point of view, was, you know, I spent probably, I'd say 30% of my time actually working on the communication layers for every version of Wildcat and the modem control layer. Because, you know, trying to get the modem to properly pick up automatically was a constant fight for me because, you know, every single modem, remember we were selling this as a software package and people were using every brand of modem that was out there. And every brand of modem had, you know, different timing delays when they would, you know, send a ring, you know, then I'd have to send an ATA to have it answer. And the biggest problems with Wildcat in the early days was just getting it to work with all the modems to automatically answer, because there was nothing worse than to be a sysop and to sit there staring at a screen waiting for somebody to call into your bulletin board and then to not have it answer the phone. I mean, that was like death to finally get that phone call to come in and then for the thing to not answer. And so I spent countless hours on working on the communication layers to make sure that Wildcat never missed a call. And then as BBSs started getting busier, you had to deal with, you know, okay, now you have to hang up on, you know, the person hangs up and now you have to immediately reset and be ready for the next call within, you know, a second or two. So
that brings up a great point. You know, Scott was asking about what sysop means, and that reminds me of something you don't get today when you build a website today. You know, when you were a sysop back in these times, your computer typically had one modem and could only handle one phone call at a time. In later days of the BBS industry, there was ways to have multi-lines and do more than that. But early on, you really had one line. And the cool thing about being a sysop was you would sit there and stare at your computer and it's sitting there saying, waiting for a call. And then as soon as the phone rings, you know, as Jim said, we do all this handshaking and stuff and we answer the phone. And then as a sysop, you got to watch. You got to watch everything the person did on your site as they're typing and stuff. You actually see them, the menus draw on the screen. You can see them go from menu to menu. You can see them typing messages and downloading files. And it was cool. I mean, you know, today you go look at a weblog. Wow, great. It showed me that my homepage was showed 3,500 times.
Well, it was kind of like screening your calls, right? Someone calls your voicemail. See, I was going to say voicemail. Someone calls your answering machine, and you can listen to them in real time talking. There's a certain voyeurism there, being able to watch people do that. Eventually, though, when bulletin boards became big on messaging and people would leave messages, I would turn that feature off because I don't want to watch someone leaving messages.
Yeah, we actually, you know, as soon as it got multi-line, it was impossible to do that anyways. But it was cool, especially in the early days when it was really, really community-driven. You know, if you watch somebody struggling on your BBS, you would just press a button on your keyboard and you could actually help them out.
And interrupt them and say, "Hi, it's me. I'm the sysop. What can I do to help?"
And then let's not forget the coolness of when companies like DeskView came out, and all of a sudden we could now, you know, multitask on our PCs, and then we had to figure out ways to put multiple modems in those PCs and have multiple versions of, you know, have DeskView running in multiple windows and running, you know, multiple DOS applications in Windows. Those were some DeskView. Pretty interesting times to have to figure out how to make all of that work and how to make still that, you know, time slicing and you know, communication layers still run, even though it was sharing resources across multiple windows.
Because it was cooperative multitasking. The DeskView was DeskView, and that was a quarter deck product, if I remember correctly, and it was text mode, and I would run basically these text mode windows. It smelled a lot like TurboVision, which was the windowing thing for Turbo Pascal, but it was basically back in the days when we were drawing windows with ASCII art and ANSI art. And I used to run Tweak Computer Support BBS, and I had DeskView running four lines and Wildcat software in each window. And then I moved over to OS 2 when I got my 8 megs of RAM. I had 8 megabytes of RAM. I had more RAM than in the entire block combined. I remember hooking up all my dips, my tiny dip memory, fields and fields of dips, filling my 386DX with 8 megs of RAM and then running OS 2. It was a very amazing feeling to have that much going on.
You were probably using Quarterdeck's multiple RAM card at the time, too, to extend your memory, weren't you?
Yeah, and then remembering there were kind of these silly little geek competitions as people would try to optimize their config sys and their autoexec bat and make sure that everything gets loaded into upper memory. And there was a tool called QEMM, which was the Quarterdeck memory manager that would let you...
Extended memory manager, yeah. Quarterdeck extended memory manager.
And then people would say... So, and basically what that would do is it would reboot your machine over and over and over again and try different scenarios until it found the one that worked, and kind of playing Tetris with your memory. And then eventually people decided that they could do it better than QEMM. So we just write them all out on paper and make the decisions ourselves. And all of this was in an attempt to squeeze another line or another instance of Wildcat or whatever we were running into what little memory we had.
Yeah, and to think that people think computers are hard today, I mean...
Well, that's what I think. I think that some of the old-timers like ourselves that suffered through the 300 baud days want to remind the kids with the 20 megabits per second Fios optical connection to their house what real suffering looked like, right? And of course, as we reminisce about 300 baud, some listener who worked on punch cards is saying, these kids with their V32 bis and their 2400 baud modems, they don't know what real suffering is like.
That's right.
I'll tell you a funny story about the whole Mustang Wildcat stuff we were in our heyday in the mid-90s. So we took the company public in the early 90s, and we're a public company traded on NASDAQ, and all this kind of stuff. We're flying high. You know, we're at the peak of the BBS industry, and we're having good times. And in those days, the big computer show that, once again, it doesn't exist, of course, anymore, was COMDEX. And for many, many years, every year at COMDEX, we would go and have a big booth and show off our BBS technology. And then it was in 1995 that we have our booth. We're showing off our Wildcat stuff, our Q-modem stuff. And right behind our booth is a company called Netscape.
Uh-oh.
And I remember I'm at the booth, and Jim goes, "Hey, Scott, you need to go over and look at this Netscape stuff." And, you know, for those that, you know, have only seen Firefox and Internet Explorer, you know, Netscape was the starting of web browsing. And so they were showing off their first web browser. And, you know, I think everybody from our company walked over there and sat down and saw this and were like, "Wow."
Back then, what a lot of people don't realize is, you know, from at least from my perspective, is, you know, the internet started, you know, as a way to, you know, connect multiple computers, and then, you know, was an early times, at least what I remember, was, you know, email came, and then we sat around a room when we first got an internet connection at Mustang and said, okay, now how do we connect all of our, you know, we had 53,000 Wildcat bulletin board systems out in the universe, and so our goal was to figure out ways to connect all of these to actually kind of create our first web, really, of BBSs, where somebody could, you know, post a message, you know, using the back then the FIDO technology. We kind of took it and took it to the next level, where somebody could post a message in Bakersfield for somebody in Chicago, and then have it route, you know, through, what was it, the TC, well, help me out with some of the terms we used back then, Scott, but we used it through, we went through the actual internet layer to send that message, to package it up, and then send it across to the Chicago BBS, where somebody then locally could dial in and grab their email.
Hi, it's Scott here from Another Place in Time. I hope you're enjoying the show so far. I apologize for interrupting it, but I wanted to let you know that assembling a podcast like this every week isn't free. Certainly the bandwidth bill crushes us every month, so I want to let you know that this show is sponsored by Telerik. They make the show possible, and they make some pretty cool products as well. For example, if you're trying to build a Web 2.0 AJAXE application, trying to use the Web 1.0 components, it's kind of difficult. You got to get the next-gen stuff if you want to build the next-gen websites, and that's exactly what the folks at Telerik have got in their new upcoming product, which is codenamed Rad Controls Prometheus. It's a big pack of web controls built entirely on top of the Microsoft ASP.NET AJAX stuff that you already understand. It's going to give you a lot of performance and interactivity on your next project. They mirror the ASP.NET AJAX API, so the development's really straightforward. Client scripts are shared, loading time is pretty fast. You set a couple of properties, you can even bind to web services for a really efficient operation. The new RAD editor for ASP.NET AJAX loads up to 4 times faster than before, and the RAD grid will do thousands of records in milliseconds. But of course, it's better to try these things for yourself, so you can visit telerik.com/ASP.NET AJAX and download a trial. Thanks a lot for listening, and we'll get right back to the show. Let's back up a sec, because you mentioned FidoNet a couple of times. Let's talk about what FidoNet was for people who don't necessarily remember that.
Yeah, so FidoNet, the whole point of FidoNet was, you know, back in the mid-80s, it was very expensive to make long-distance phone calls. And so your challenge was, let's say that Scott Hanselman lives in Portland, Oregon, and Scott Hunter lives in Little Rock, Arkansas, and I want to send you a message. Well, I don't want to dial into your BBS in Portland, Oregon, because that's going to, you know, that's going to cost me a dollar a minute or whatever the heck it was in those days. And so the idea behind FidoNet was I can have a message board on my BBS that's shared all the way across the country. And what happens is once in the middle of the night, 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, your BBS might call my BBS, and when it does, my BBS will basically take all the messages that you have not seen, zip them up, and shoot them over to you. And this is occurring. There was thousands of BBSs that were doing this every single night. Every single night, these BBSs would be calling each other and transferring all their messages back and forth. And so the benefit for the end user was, if I was on your BBS in Portland, I could send a message to Scott Hunter, and over a 24-hour period, it would show up on my BBS in Arkansas, and I could respond, and we would have a conversation. But it was, you know, that's something else. You know, people are spoiled today by, you know, I send an email, and it shows up on somebody's desk in 1 or 2 seconds. And in the mid-80s, the way that worked is I would send you an email, and it would show up, you know, on your computer in 24 hours.
Right. And we would for those of us that were children at the time, in that time in the late 80s, I was still a kid, I would try to call as far as I could without making a long-distance call.
Exactly.
So for the cheap amongst us, basically we would figure out what's the farthest east that I could call. And for me, I think it was Walla Walla, Washington. And I would call a bulletin board in Walla Walla, which was the FidoNet node that wasn't long-distance. And then we would bounce ourselves around the country a little bit at a time at 2 in the morning, without actually making a long-distance call. And that was about the most amazing thing ever. But these addresses that we were using were FidoNet addresses, and we were talking to FidoNet forums. So we weren't quite on the internet yet. And then in Portland, the big bulletin board system around Portland, which was Northwest Computer Support, they were like the 700-pound gorilla. I actually visited their offices once, and they had like 32 modems and a whole room dedicated to this. And the little guy couldn't compete. And they hooked up FidoNet to the internet. and then started giving their users, for I think it was like $5 a month, a free nwcs.org email address. And they bridged TCPIP and FidoNet. And suddenly things got really interesting. And we were bulletin board people, which were kind of like, it was the alt net, were on the actual net, which before was really only college students and scientists and rich people.
Yeah, yeah, those bring back a lot of memories. They really do. What was amazing was, just like you said, that the whole BBS community figured out a way to start wiring all these BBSs together without really ever making a long distance call. But it also was the very first time you could actually have really message boards that could have different themes to them, and then those mm-hmm. message boards could be active worldwide. And so, you know, when you look at the social aspect of what bulletin board systems were really doing back, you know, in the you know, the mid 90s, you know, late 80s, early 90s, it's really amazing to see, you know, they really were the first social network, you know, that at least that's my opinion.
Yeah, I think that the point that you made earlier about how comfortable you were getting to know these people, and that they made you feel welcomed. And this is 25 years ago, and still computer culture was such that you could ask questions and not necessarily feel like a huge noob, because people would welcome you with open arms and say, here's somebody trying to do something cool.
Yeah, and there wasn't really, I mean, even though people were competing, there were so many bulletin boards now that people were starting to, you know, to compete in the early 90s and mid 90s, just because, you know, of natural competition, people wanted to have a better BBS than their neighbor. It was a friendly competition. Most BBSs, when they met a new sysop, would go over to their house and help them set it up. I mean, I helped multiple people set up bulletin board systems, another guy we brought in the company, Rick Hemming, we met him because he was running another bulletin board system product called RBVS, which stood for Remote Bulletin Board System, and he was running that product, and that's how we met, and he ended up being another partner at Mustang and mm-hmm. You know, really helped us take the company to the next level as well. So, and that was all because of just friendships that were made, and then the sysop get-togethers at Comdex, and then you know, the industry started creating its own user conferences and everything, and it was an interesting and kind of memorable time, really, of my life to remember all those folks that came to those meetings.
Now, did you guys see the end coming, or did you sell before it took a dive?
No, we did. As I said, we saw the end coming in 95 when we were actually at that Comdex and we saw Netscape. Uh-huh. I mean, we knew at that point the world was changing. I mean, that was the tip of the iceberg. Was that the world was changing? And I don't know. And Jim can correct me if I'm wrong. I don't think we realized how big the change was going to be and how fast the change was going to come. But Mustang Software, fortunately, to kind of do the short end of the stick, is as that industry started to decline, we internally looked at ourselves and said, okay, we know this is going to, we see this declining now. Let's go find another niche to go build mm-hmm. an industry in. And so mm-hmm. the niche that we built, what we did internally as a company, this is kind of, might be interesting to some people, is, we basically the company kind of scaled down after the industry started slowing down, and we took our development team and basically just cut it up into about four pieces, and said, we went in there and put four ideas on a whiteboard, and cut the company in four pieces, and mm-hmm. said, we're going to have a snippet of people work on each of these four things. And one of the four things, I got to give Jim credit for this. This was his idea. Was you know, as the internet's starting to spin up and people are getting online, you know, on the net now, mm-hmm. email was becoming a big issue. So let's say you're a company and you're selling your product on the internet, and imagine how many emails you must get. So suddenly we've gone from brick and mortar to we have an online web page and we're selling our products on the internet, and we're getting 500 messages an hour via email asking questions. And when we were supporting Wildcat, At one point, our support group, we had an aspect call center, which is one of these call center things that as the phone calls spin in, as people are calling for technical support, we had a board on the wall that showed how many people were in queue, the longest it's in queue, and Jim came up with the crazy idea of doing that for email. You know, what if 1,000 emails are coming in an hour? How do you handle that? How do you make sure your employees answered every one of those? And so one of those four ideas was a product called Internet Message Center. And what it basically did is it would take your emails and put them into a queue. And as soon as the email came in, it would send the user a response back saying, hey, we've got your email. Here's a ticket number. If you don't get a response in within 24 hours, call back or email back and give us your ticket number, and we can find out, you know, where your request went. And what would happen on the other end is that the email would go into a queue. All the users in the support group would run a little applet on their desktop that showed the queues, how many messages were in the queues. As soon as they were done with a message, they click a button on that interface, and the next email comes through onto their desktop. And all of this is being tracked and stored and stuff. So we get, you know, just like a call center would do this, we're doing this for email. You know, let's say you did call and say, hey, I haven't got a response in 24 hours. As the admin of the support group, I could go look up with that tracking number and say, okay, well, the email came into our email server at 3:00 in the afternoon. Joe and John both looked at it, and they have not sent a response yet. We could actually see the entire history of the conversations and stuff. And so we actually rebuilt Mustang around this product. So we didn't actually get out before the fall of this industry, but we actually reinvented the company before that industry, you know, perished.
Right.
Yeah, and kind of winding down, like rewinding a little bit. So in 95, and as Scott mentioned, in November of 95, we were at Convex, and one of the things our company always did was, instead of taking our sales and marketing people to Convex, I loaded up all of our programmers and engineers because I wanted them to actually work in the booth and connect with the customers. Because then when customers would walk up and go, why do you do this? This isn't very smart. I would do it this way. To me, I always wanted our programmers hearing those comments and not the sales and marketing team. So, and it was always nice to get the programmers kind of out of the office for a week as well and let them, you know, kind of regenerate their batteries. And so when we saw Netscape catty-quarter to us in Convex in November of 95, as Scott mentioned, I had all the programmers kind of go through. And the thing that that amazed us is, you know, it wasn't about the BBS anymore. It wasn't about, you know, with BBS is it was you were calling into a specific location to look at their content. And what the World Wide Web brought with the browsing technology was really more about content. It wasn't about where the content was located. It was about the content period and the fact that you could put multiple links of content on one page and make it graphical. Even though the BBS industry was moving to a more graphical platform at that time, it was still, you know, all of the information was on that particular bulletin board system. And so as soon as we noticed that, hey, it's not going to be about the BBS anymore, or where the server is located, it's really about the content. We knew that the end was going to be near. I don't think we anticipated that within a year our entire product line would be eradicated, which is, you know, Scott, how quickly it happened. I mean, we went from being on top of the world in November of 95 to having very little, you know, very few customers in November of 96, which is when we started developing these four products that Scott Hunter just mentioned. And so within a year, we went from having 53,000 bulletin board systems to probably, I'd say, under 5,000. It happened that quick as people migrated to the World Wide Web.
Wow, that is crazy. And I wonder if there would have been a way, this is all hindsight is 2020, blogs really hadn't happened yet, but to have turned Wildcat into a content management system of a sort, to move the BBS to the web.
Well, we spent 96 kind of doing that. We came out with a product called Annihilator, which was our Wildcat bulletin board system that had we acquired a product called QModem, which was a communications product, and we kind of built our own browser, web browser, into that platform that would talk specifically to Wildcat bulletin board systems. And so the first thing we tried to do, because we just, you know, we honestly didn't think the World Wide Web would take off that quickly. We knew we had 53,000 Wildcat systems out there, and we knew we had, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, if not millions of people, using those 53,000 systems. And so we, the first thing we tried to do was put a, you know, a web based interface into our QModem product to connect to these systems. But the technology was just starting to evolve so quickly that it was just trying to, you know, stay above water. And the thing that Scott Hunter and I laugh about today is when you think about bulletin board systems, well, you know, we had chat in Wildcat, and you remember when people would join into, when you had a multi-user BBS, people would, you know, go into chat. Well, you know, that was when we saw AIM come out with American Online Instant Messaging come out. We were like, oh crap, we missed that one, you know, because we had instant messaging in Wildcat. And then, you know, when Yahoo Groups, you know, first appeared, we were like, oh crap, we missed that one. We had groups in Wildcat, you know. And so every turn we were kind of like, we were like, oh man, there's little bits and pieces of Wildcat being used on the internet now, and just one little facet of it, and they're becoming so popular. And so it was kind of an interesting time for us to sit back and watch kind of bits and pieces of Wildcat being redeployed on the internet as a single application, and other people were benefiting from that. And we were like, well, we missed that one. But, you know, but we did well with, you know, with you know, Internet Message Center was a huge success for us. So, you know, we got something right. But there's a lot of other things that we kind of, you know, kick ourselves about, because we'd created some white papers about deploying some of those features of Wildcat on the net, and we just never, you know, it never bubbled up enough for us to spend any R&D time on it.
Yeah, we actually, as Jim said, we actually talked about taking the instant messaging out of Wildcat and making a standalone product. That would have been AOL Instant Messenger or MSN Messenger.
Or ICQ.
I mean, we talked, as Jim said, it was like 2 or 3 years in a row we were watching all these things, phenomena happen over the internet. We're like going, God, we did that. We just never did rip it out of the BBS and did it on the internet. And as Jim said, we actually had a product called WinServer. It was the code name for it was Annihilator, which was actually a version of Wildcat that had an HTTP server in it, so it served web pages. You could telnet into it, so, you know, if once you were on the internet, you could actually use telnet to sign in and get the old modem interface via telnet. We actually even had an internet client very similar to what AOL was when AOL first came out, a thick client. You know, you install this client on your desktop and you get this application, and when you use this application to connect to a Wildcat internet wind server, and when you do, you know, it looks just like the AOL does. So at one point we actually were going around saying, hey, we'll sell you a mini AOL, because we have the client and the server piece. But, you know, as Jim said, that I don't know if it was just because we were so BBS-centric at the time that each of our solutions around that area were still just too tied to the BBS. We never ripped them all apart, and as a result, as a collection, they didn't do well. But, you know, as Jim said, you know, and the story I was telling earlier, the Internet Message Center stuff was wildly popular, and that's what eventually led us out of that space was, you know, our company was purchased for that product.
So you guys changed your name from Mustang Software to Mustang.com, right?
Yes.
That's correct. That was back when, you know, we had to kind of reinvent the company, because remember, we were public, and all of a sudden, within that 12-month period where the BBS market just got absolutely just eradicated, had to figure out a way to reinvent the company. And so part of that was a name change, and I just could not let go of the name Mustang. And so, you know, our board of directors talked, and we finally just said, let's go to Mustang.com, and let's release our new web-based products underneath that name and part of our reinventing the company. And so that's why we changed the name.
Well, then a couple of months later, you merged with Quintus, right? And then that got bought by Avaya. Is there anything left of Mustang Software?
Yeah, I know that the some of the code is being used in Avaya's contact management application. So, you know, the reason why they bought us is they had call center technology already. They had fax inbound fax technology to manage that in the call center. They just didn't have the email piece. So now, you know, they can have one person sitting at a console, and if a phone call comes in, you know, the phone is delivered, you know, to their headset, and a screen pop, you know, with the user's total account information is in front of them. Or if an email pops in, you know, like to you know, sales@nordstrom.com, then the same thing, it's, you know, that message is, you know, popped on their screen, their phone is automatically put in a busy state, and they're, you know, they're measured on how quickly they can answer that email. And there's a database of answers. We built a natural language engine that would automatically read and scan the message and then pop up paragraphs that the agent could just drag and drop right into those reply messages. So now a person using the Avaya Contact Center can handle a phone, a fax, an email coming into that contact center.
It must be strange to look back and have it be gone. I mean, I still kind of miss BBSs a little bit, and then, you know, I don't know. It's almost like it was all a dream. If that's kind of a funny way to mention it, though. But I mean, it was a 5 or 10 year period there, where as a user of a BBS, whereas as a person that ran a BBS, it was just like we thought that was the pinnacle. You know, it was just going to get better and better. I definitely didn't see the internet coming in any way myself.
The part that I miss the most about it, and I don't know why the internet's different. It might just be because there's more people on it. Was, you know, I remember in 85 when we ran these BBSs, and especially early in the BBS, even BBSs got a little darker, I should say, as time went on. It was amazing just how nice people were, how nice the community was. you look at the websites today and the blogs and the comments and stuff and the negativity and stuff like that. And, you know, God, in 1985, if you went somewhere, nobody would call you stupid. Nobody said you were dumb for running something. You know, how can I help you? I'll come to your house and help. It was a different time. That's the part of it that I missed, the innocence.
The whole concept of flames and flaming and you know, which is when you're being negative to somebody in a message board, really didn't start till about 91. That's when that whole concept of flames and people started getting used to using real anonymous names and hiding behind these anonymous names. And I think you're right, Scott. It before that period of time, it was more of just, you know, full disclosure and being and really just being helpful, because, you know, you had to, a sysop back then had to be really kind of, you know, an expert in their own mind. And there was really, you know, besides the books that we all bought, you know, there, that was the only other resource was to get on these bulletin board systems and ask questions, you know, to figure out how to write those, how to edit those config sys files, and how to use dot, you know, how to use Edlin to edit your DOS files. It was a different time. And, you know, teaching people how to use these, how to, you know, go in and create automated batch files and stuff was just a different time, as Scott said.
Yeah, I miss it. That's what I don't know about you, Scott Hanselman, but that's what I missed the most about it, was just the innocence of it and how friendly people were. And
yeah.
And, you know, it didn't matter if you were running DR DOS or DOS or Stacker, which, you know, various products of that era, nobody cared. I mean, it was just about the community.
Well, and the slowness of things right now, I'm finding that the urgency addiction of the internet is a problem, in the sense of if I can't get an answer in 20 minutes, then I start getting pretty upset. But, you know, back in the day, you'd leave a message on CompuServe or up on a bulletin board, and you'd sit around for 3 or 4 days and you'd wonder if it was going to get answered. And that was okay.
That could be part of it. You know, that's a great point. You know, today it's so instant. You know, back in those days, when you responded to somebody, you didn't try to respond, you know, really quickly anyways. But if a message came to me, I'm not going to go, God, I need to respond to this in the next 10 minutes, because the reality is it's going to take a day to get to them. So, so you know, I think you thought more about the response, and it was a great industry. And like you said, I still can't think that, you know, gosh, it's only been gone for, 15 years now or something like that. I mean, it was amazing how fast that industry blew up and then how fast it went away. And
yeah. It wasn't that long ago.
It took us 9 years, you know, really from you know, when you think about, you know, 87 to 96, it was 9 years of really just, you know, being focused and trying to drive that, until we really had to start, you know, really totally switching into another gear with the internet. So I'm just glad that, you know, I was a part of it. I was glad that, you know, there's a lot of other people that were a part of it. There's other BBS products that that challenged us to take it to the next level. There, you know, you know, I miss some of those guys that I competed with back then, the Scott Brinkers of the world, you know, because they really pushed us to be, you know, to be the best we possibly could. And our customers were so loyal. I mean, you know, when somebody started running a Wildcat BBS, they really evangelized our product to their friends and help friends set up their own BBSs. And, you know, piracy really wasn't a big problem for us, because people were proud of running it. And, you know, it was, I just think it was great to be part of that era. And I'm really, you know, happy that I was able to participate in it.
Yeah, that was the other thing about, you know, when I talk about the community and stuff in those days. I mean, our big competitors were, there was PC Board, there was Major BBS, which is the one by Tim Stryker that Jim was mentioning. There was IBBS, which was TBBS. We competed very heavily with all these guys, but at the same time, you know, we would go have a beer with them as well. I mean, we'd show up for a BBS convention and. It was not uncommon to go to dinner and have a beer with all those guys. So, you know, even the companies that were fighting in the trenches in that space were pretty friendly.
Well, people can go up to Wikipedia and look for Mustang Software, and at the very bottom of the Wikipedia article on Mustang, there's an external link to a book. It's a 57 meg PDF called The History of Mustang that has a lot of the detail that we've talked about and a lot of stories and pictures and information. That people who are interested in BBS culture should definitely check out. And then people should also search the internet for the BBS documentary, which is kind of the legendary documentary describing all things bulletin board. And these basically someone wandered around for a year or two interviewing people from bulletin boards all over. Are you guys in that documentary?
Some of our employees were. I was traveling when they came by, but a lot of they came to the Mustang campus and sat on the couch with several of our engineers and actually interviewed them. So there's some great clips of those folks in there.
Very cool. People can see that at bbsdocumentary.com.
There's definitely two or three of our engineers that were involved in that documentary.
You can see that at bbsdocumentary.com or search for BBS Documentary on Google Video, and it's been released as Creative Commons, so you can see it in multiple parts up online or get a DVD set. And then both of you guys are on Twitter now, the new BBS. So I'll put links to your Twitter names as well.
Great. Well, we'd love to hear from people that ever ran bulletin board systems. Be sure to send us a message and speak up so we can see you and bring back some more memories.
You know what we should do? We should make a Facebook group for users and sysops of Wildcat Software. You should set that up, Jim.
Yeah, I'll do that.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Jim Harar and Scott Hunter, for sitting down and talking about bulletin boards and Mustang Software. We appreciate all the work that you guys did to keep us connected even 25 years ago.
It was our pleasure. And thank you for having us on today.
Thanks, Scott.
Well, this has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I'll see you again next week.